Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. The Suicide Club, Story of the Young Man with the Cream Tarts, by Robert Louis Stevenson. During his residence in London, the accomplished Prince Florizel of Bohemia gained the affection of all classes by the seduction of his manner and by a well-considered generosity. He was a remarkable man even by what was known of him, and that was but a small part of what he actually did. Although of a placid temper in ordinary circumstances and accustomed to take the world with as much philosophy as any ploughman, the Prince of Bohemia was not without a taste for ways of life more adventurous and eccentric than that to which he was destined by his birth. Now and then, when he fell into a low humor, when there was no laughable play to witness in any of the London theatres, and when the season of the year was unsuitable to those field sports in which he excelled all competitors, he would summon his confidant and master of the horse, Colonel Geraldine, and bid him prepare himself against an evening ramble. The master of the horse was a young officer of a brave and even temerarious disposition. He greeted the news with delight and hastened to make ready. Long practice and a varied acquaintance of life had given him a singular facility in disguise. He could adapt not only his face and bearing, but his voice and almost his thoughts to those of any rank, character, or nation, and in this way he diverted attention from the prince and sometimes gained admission for the pair into strange societies. The civil authorities were never taken into the secret of these adventures. The imperturbable courage of the one and the ready invention and chivalrous devotion of the other had brought them through a score of dangerous passes, and they grew in confidence as time went on. One evening in March they were driven by a sharp fall of sleet into an oyster bar in the immediate neighborhood of Leicester Square. Colonel Geraldine was dressed and painted to represent a person connected with the press in reduced circumstances, while the prince had, as usual, travestied his appearance by the addition of false whiskers and a pair of large adhesive eyebrows. These lent him a shaggy and weather-beaten air, which for one of his urbanity formed the most impenetrable disguise. Thus equipped, the commander and his satellite sipped their brandy and soda in security. The bar was full of guests, both male and female, but though more than one of these offered to fall into talk with our adventurers, none of them promised to grow interesting upon a nearer acquaintance. There was nothing present but the lees of London and the commonplace of disrespectability, and the prince had already fallen to a yawning and was beginning to grow weary of the whole excursion, when the swing doors were pushed violently open and a young man, followed by a couple of commissionaires, entered the bar. Each of the commissionaires carried a large dish of cream tarts under cover, which they at once removed, and the young man made the round of company and pressed these confections upon every one's acceptance with an exaggerated courtesy. Sometimes his offer was laughingly accepted, sometimes it was firmly or even harshly rejected. In these latter cases, the newcomer always ate the tart himself, with some more or less humorous commentary. At last he accosted Prince Florizel. "Sir," said he, with a profound obeisance, proffering the tart at the same time between his thumb and forefinger, "will you so far honor an entire stranger? I can answer for the quality of the pastry, having eaten 24 and 3 of them myself since 5 o'clock. "I am in the habit," replied the prince, "of looking not so much to the nature of a gift as to the spirit in which it is offered." "The spirit, sir," returned the young man, with another bow, "is one of mockery." "Mockery?" repeated Florizel. "And whom do you propose to mock?" "I am not here to expound my philosophy," replied the other, "but to distribute these cream tarts. If I mention that I heartily include myself in the ridicule of the transaction, I hope you will consider honor satisfied and condescend. If not, you will constrain me to eat my 28th, and I own to being weary of this exercise." "You touch me," said the prince, "and I have all the will in the world to rescue you from this dilemma, but upon one condition. If my friend and I eat your cakes, for which we have neither of us any natural inclination, we shall expect you to join us at supper by way of recompense." The young man seemed to reflect. "I have still several dozen upon hand," he said at last, "and that will make it necessary for me to visit several more bars before my great affair is concluded. This will take some time, and if you are hungry—" The prince interrupted him with a polite gesture. "My friend and I will accompany you," he said, "for we have already a deep interest in your very agreeable mode of passing an evening. And now that the preliminaries of peace are settled, allow me to sign the treaty for both." And the prince swallowed the tart with the best grace imaginable. "It is delicious," said he. "I perceive you are a connoisseur," replied the young man. Colonel Geraldine likewise did honor to the pastry, and every one in that bar, having now either accepted or refused his delicacies, the young man with the cream tarts led the way to another and similar establishment. The two commissionaires, who seemed to have grown accustomed to their absurd employment, followed immediately after, and the prince and the colonel brought up the rear, arm in arm, smiling to each other as they went. In this order, the company visited two other taverns, where scenes were enacted of a like nature to that already described, some refusing, some accepting, the favors of this vagabond hospitality, and the young man himself eating each rejected tart. On leaving the third saloon, the young man counted his store. There were but 9 remaining, 3 in one tray and 6 in the other. "Gentlemen," said he, addressing himself to his 2 new followers, "I am unwilling to delay your supper. I am positively sure you must be hungry. I feel that I owe you a special consideration. And on this great day for me, when I am closing a career of folly by my most conspicuously silly action, I wish to behave handsomely to all who give me countenance. Gentlemen, you shall wait no longer. Although my constitution is shattered by previous excesses, at the risk of my life I liquidate the suspensory condition." With these words he crushed the 9 remaining tarts into his mouth and swallowed them at a single movement each. Then, turning to the commissionaires, he gave them a couple of sovereigns. "I have to thank you," said he, "for your extraordinary patience." And he dismissed them with a bow apiece. For some seconds he stood looking at the purse from which he had just paid his assistants. Then, with a laugh, he tossed it into the middle of the street and signified his readiness for supper. In a small French restaurant in Soho, which had enjoyed an exaggerated reputation for some little while, but had already begun to be forgotten, and in a private room up 2 pair of stairs, the 3 companions made a very elegant supper and drank 3 or 4 bottles of champagne, talking the while upon indifferent subjects. The young man was fluent and gay, but he laughed louder than was natural in a person of polite breeding. His hands trembled violently, and the voice took sudden and surprising inflections, which seemed to be independent of his will. The dessert had been cleared away, and all 3 had lighted their cigars when the prince addressed him in these words. "You will, I am sure, pardon my curiosity. What I have seen of you has greatly pleased, but even more puzzled me. And though I should be loath to seem indiscreet, I must tell you that my friend and I are persons very well worthy to be entrusted with a secret. We have many of our own, which we are continually revealing to improper ears. And if, as I suppose, your story is a silly one, you need have no delicacy with us, who are 2 of the silliest men in England. My name is Godall, Theophilus Godall. My friend is Major Alfred Hammersmith, or at least such is the name by which he chooses to be known. We pass our lives entirely in the search for extravagant adventures, and there is no extravagance with which we are not capable of sympathy." "I like you, Mr. Godall," returned the young man. "You inspire me with a natural confidence, and I have not the slightest objection to our friend, the Major, whom I take to be a nobleman in masquerade. At least I am sure he's no soldier." The colonel smiled at this compliment to the perfection of his art, and the young man went on in a more animated manner. "There is every reason why I should not tell you my story. Perhaps that is just the reason why I am going to do so. At least you seem so well prepared to hear a tale of silliness that I cannot find it in my heart to disappoint you. My name, in spite of your example, I shall keep to myself. My age is not essential to the narrative. I am descended from my ancestors by ordinary generation, and from them I inherited the very eligible human tenement which I still occupy, and a fortune of £300 a year. I suppose they also handed on to me a hare-brained humor, which it has been my chief delight to indulge. I received a good education. I can play the violin nearly well enough to earn money in the orchestra of a penny gaff, but not quite. The same remark applies to the flute and the French horn. I learned enough of whist to lose about 100 a year at that scientific game. My acquaintance with French was sufficient to enable me to squander money in Paris with almost the same facility as in London. In short, I'm a person full of manly accomplishments. I have had every sort of adventure, including a duel about nothing. Only 2 months ago I met a young lady exactly suited to my taste in mind and body. I found my heart melt. I saw that I had come upon my fate at last and was in the way to fall in love. But when I came to reckon up what remained to me of my capital, I found it amounted to something less than £400. I ask you fairly, can a man who respects himself fall in love on £400? I concluded, certainly not, left the presence of my charmer, and, slightly accelerating my usual rate of expenditure, came this morning to my last £80. This I divided into two equal parts. 40 I reserved for a particular purpose. The remaining 40 I was to dissipate before the night. I have passed a very entertaining day, and played many farces besides that of the cream tarts, which procured me the advantage of your acquaintance. For I was determined, as I told you, to bring a foolish career to a still more foolish conclusion, and when you saw me throw my purse into the street, the £40 were at an end. Now you know me as well as I know myself, a fool, but consistent in his folly, and as I will ask you to believe, neither a whimperer nor a coward. From the whole tone of the young man's statement, it was plain that he harbored very bitter and contemptuous thoughts about himself. His auditors were led to imagine that his love affair was nearer his heart than he admitted, and that he had a design on his own life. The farce of the cream tarts began to have very much the air of tragedy in disguise. "Why is this not odd?" broke out Geraldine, giving a look to Prince Florizel, "that we three fellows should have met by the merest accident in so large a wilderness as London, and should be so nearly in the same condition." "How?" cried the young man. "Are you two ruined? Is this supper a folly like my cream tarts? Has the devil brought three of his own together for a last carouse?" "The devil, depend on it, can sometimes do a very gentlemanly thing," returned Prince Florizel, "and I am so much touched by this coincidence that, although we are not entirely in the same case, I am going to put an end to the disparity. Let your heroic treatment of the last cream tarts be my example." So saying, the prince drew out his purse and took from it a small bundle of banknotes. "You see, I was a week or so behind you, but I mean to catch you up and come neck and neck into the winning post," he continued. "This," laying one of the notes upon the table, "will suffice for the bill. As for the rest," he tossed them into the fire, and they went up the chimney in a single blaze. The young man tried to catch his arm, but as the table was between them, his interference came too late. "Unhappy man!" he cried. "You should not have burned them all. You should have kept £40." "£40?" repeated the prince. "Why, in heaven's name, £40?" "Why not 80?" cried the colonel. "For to my certain knowledge there must have been 100 in the bundle." "It was only £40 he needed," said the young man gloomily. "But without them there's no admission. The rule is strict. £40 for each. A cursed life, where a man cannot even die without money." The prince and the colonel exchanged glances. "Explain yourself," said the latter. "I have still a pocketbook tolerably well lined, and I need not say how readily I would share my wealth with Gottel. But I must know to what end. You must certainly tell us what you mean." The young man seemed to awaken. He looked uneasily from one to the other, and his face flushed deeply. "You are not fooling me?" he asked. "You are indeed ruined men like me?" "Indeed I am, for my part," replied the colonel. "And for mine," said the prince. "I have given you proof. Who but a ruined man would throw his notes into the fire? The action speaks for itself." "A ruined man, yes," returned the other suspiciously, "or else a millionaire." "Enough, sir," said the prince. "I have said so, and I'm not accustomed to have my word remain in doubt." "Ruined?" said the young man. "Are you ruined like me? Are you, after a life of indulgence, come to such a pass that you can only indulge yourself in one thing more? Are you—" he kept lowering his voice as he went on—"are you going to give yourself that last indulgence? Are you going to avoid the consequences of your folly by the one infallible and easy path? Are you going to give the slip to the sheriff's officers of conscience by the one open door?" Suddenly he broke off and attempted to laugh. "Here is to your health," he cried, emptying his glass, "and good night to you, my merry ruined men." Colonel Geraldine caught him by the arm as he was about to rise. "You lack confidence in us," he said, "but you are wrong. To all your questions I make answer in the affirmative. But I am not so timid and can speak the Queen's English plainly. We, too, like yourself, have had enough of life and are determined to die. Sooner or later, alone or together, we mean to seek out death and beard him where he lies ready. Since we have met you and your case is more pressing, let it be tonight and at once, and if you will, all three together. Such a penniless trio," he cried, "should go arm in arm into the hall of Pluto and give each other some countenance among the shades." Geraldine had hit exactly on the manners and intonations that became the part he was playing. The prince himself was disturbed and looked over at his confidant with a shade of doubt. As for the young man, the flush came back darkly into his cheek and his eyes threw out a spark of light. "You are the men for me," he cried, with an almost terrible gaiety. "Shake hands upon the bargain." His hand was cold and wet. "You little know in what a company you will begin the march. You little know in what a happy moment for yourselves you partook of my cream tarts. I'm only a unit, but I'm a unit in an army. I know death's private door. I am one of his familiars and can show you into eternity without ceremony and yet without scandal." They called upon him eagerly to explain his meaning. "Can you muster 80 pounds between you?" he demanded. Geraldine ostentatiously consulted his pocketbook and replied in the affirmative. "Fortunate beings," cried the young man, "40 pounds is the entry money of the Suicide Club." "The Suicide Club," said the prince, "why, what the devil is that?" "Listen," said the young man, "this is the age of conveniences, and I have to tell you of the last perfection of the sort. We have affairs in different places, and hence railways were invented. Railways separated us infallibly from our friends, and so telegraphs were made that we might communicate speedily at great distances. Even in hotels we have lifts to spare us a climb of some 100 steps. Now we know that life is only a stage to play the fool upon as long as the part amuses us. There was one more convenience lacking to modern comfort, a decent, easy way to quit that stage, the back stairs to liberty, or, as I said this moment, death's private door. This, my two fellow rebels, is supplied by the Suicide Club. Do not suppose that you and I are alone or even exceptional in the highly reasonable desire that we profess. A large number of our fellow men, who have grown heartily sick of the performance in which they are expected to join daily and all their lives long, are only kept from flight by one or two considerations. Some have families who would be shocked or even blamed if the matter became public. Others have a weakness at heart and recoil from the circumstances of death. That is, to some extent, my own experience. I cannot put a pistol to my head and draw the trigger, for something stronger than myself withholds the act, and although I loathe life, I have not strength enough in my body to take hold of death and be done with it. For such as I, and for all who desire to be out of the coil without posthumous scandal, the Suicide Club has been inaugurated. How this has been managed, what is its history, or what may be its ramifications in other lands, I am myself uninformed, and what I know of its constitution I am not at liberty to communicate to you. To this extent, however, I am at your service. If you are truly tired of life, I will introduce you tonight to a meeting. And if not tonight, at least sometime within the week, you will be easily relieved of your existences. It is now, consulting his watch, 11. By 11:30, at latest, we must leave this place, so that you can have 30 minutes before you to consider my proposal. It is more serious than a cream tart, he added with a smile, and I suspect more palatable. More serious, certainly, returned Colonel Geraldine, and as it is so much more so, will you allow me 5 minutes' speech in private with my friend, Mr. Goddle? It is only fair, answered the young man. If you will permit, I will retire. You will be very obliging, said the colonel. As soon as the two were alone, what, said Prince Florizel, is the use of this confabulation, Geraldine? I see you are flurried, whereas my mind is very tranquilly made up. I will see the end of this. Your Highness, said the colonel, turning pale, let me ask you to consider the importance of your life, not only to your friends, but to the public interest. If not tonight, said this madman, but supposing that tonight some irreparable disaster were to overtake your Highness's person, what, let me ask you, what would be my despair, and what concern and disaster of a great nation? I will see the end of this, repeated the prince in his most deliberate tones. And have the kindness, Colonel Geraldine, to remember and respect your word of honor as a gentleman. Under no circumstances, recollect, nor without my special authority, are you to betray the incognito under which I choose to go abroad. These were my commands, which I now reiterate. And now, he added, let me ask you to call for the bill. Colonel Geraldine bowed in submission, but he had a very white face as he summoned the young man of the cream tarts and issued his directions to the waiter. The prince preserved his undisturbed demeanor and described a Palais Royal farce to the young suicide with great humor and gusto. He avoided the colonel's appealing looks without ostentation and selected another cheroot with more than usual care. Indeed, he was now the only man of the party who kept any command over his nerves. The bill was discharged, and the prince giving the whole change of the note to the astonished waiter, and the three drove off in a four-wheeler. They were not long upon the way before the cab stopped at the entrance to a rather dark court. Here all descended. After Geraldine had paid the fare, the young man turned and addressed Prince Florizel as follows. It is still time, Mr. Godall, to make good your escape into thraldom. And for you too, Major Hammersmith. Reflect well before you take another step, and if your hearts say no, here are the crossroads. Lead on, sir, said the prince. I'm not the man to go back from a thing once said. Your coolness does me good, replied their guide. I have never seen anyone so unmoved at this conjuncture, and yet you are not the first whom I have escorted to this door. More than one of my friends has preceded me where I knew I must shortly follow. But this is of no interest to you. Wait me here for only a few moments. I shall return as soon as I have arranged the preliminaries of your introduction. And with that, the young man, waving his hand to his companions, turned into the court, entered a doorway, and disappeared. Of all our follies, said Colonel Geraldine in a low voice, this is the wildest and most dangerous. I perfectly believe so, returned the prince. We have still, pursued the colonel, a moment to ourselves. Let me beseech your highness to profit by the opportunity and retire. The consequences of this step are so dark and may be so grave, and I feel myself justified in pushing a little farther than usual the liberty which your highness is so condescending as to allow me in private. Am I to understand that Colonel Geraldine is afraid? Asked his highness, taking his cheroot from his lips and looking keenly into the other's face. My fear is certainly not personal, replied the other proudly. Of that, your highness may rest well assured. I had supposed as much, returned the prince with undisturbed good humor, but I was unwilling to remind you of the difference in our stations. No more, no more, he added, seeing Geraldine about to apologize. You stand excused. And he smoked placidly, leaning against a railing, until the young man returned. Well, he asked, has our reception been arranged? Follow me, was the reply. The President will see you in the cabinet, and let me warn you to be frank in your answers. I have stood your guarantee, but the club requires a searching inquiry before admission, for the indiscretion of a single member would lead to the dispersion of the whole society forever. The Prince and Geraldine put their heads together for a moment. Bear me out in this, said the one, and bear me out in that, said the other, and by boldly taking up the characters of men with whom both were acquainted, they had come to an agreement in a twinkling and were ready to follow their guide into the president's cabinet. There were no formidable obstacles to pass. The outer door stood open, the door of the cabinet was ajar, and there, in a small but very high apartment, the young man left them at once more. He will be here immediately, he said with a nod as he disappeared. Voices were audible in the cabinet through the folding doors which formed one end, and now and then the noise of a champagne cork, followed by a burst of laughter, intervened among the sounds of conversation. A single tall window looked out upon the river and the embankment, and by the disposition of the lights they judged themselves not far from Charing Cross Station. The furniture was scanty and the coverings worn to the thread, and there was nothing movable except the handbell in the center of a round table, and the hats and coats of a considerable party hung around the wall on pegs. "What sort of a den is this?" said Geraldine. "That is what I have come to see," replied the prince. "If they keep live devils on the premises, the thing may grow amusing." Just then the folding door was opened no more than necessary for the passage of a human body, and there entered at the same moment a louder buzz of talk and the redoubtable president of the Suicide Club. The president was a man of 50 or upward, large and rambling in his gait, the shaggy side whiskers, a bald top to his head, and a veiled gray eye, which now and then emitted a twinkle. His mouth, which embraced a large cigar, he kept continuously screwing around and around and from side to side, as he looked sagaciously and coldly at the strangers. He was dressed in light tweeds, with his neck very open, in a striped shirt collar, and carried a minute book under one arm. "Good evening," said he, after he closed the door behind him. "I am told you wish to speak with me." "We have a desire, sir, to join the Suicide Club," replied the colonel. The president rolled his cigar about in his mouth. "What is that?" he said abruptly. "Pardon me," returned the colonel, "but I believe you are the person best qualified to give us information on that point." "I?" cried the president. "A Suicide Club? Come, come, this is a frolic for All Fools' Day. I can make allowances for gentlemen who get merry in the liquor, but let there be an end to this." "Call your club what you will," said the colonel. "You have some company behind these doors, and we insist on joining it." "Sir," returned the president curtly, "you have made a mistake. This is a private house, and you must leave it instantly." The prince had remained quietly in his seat throughout this little colloquy, but now, when the colonel looked over to him as much as to say, "Take your answer and come away, for God's sake," he drew his cheroot from his mouth and spoke. "I have come here," said he, "upon the invitation of a friend of yours. He has doubtless informed you of my intention in thus intruding on your party. Let me remind you that a person in my circumstances has exceedingly little to bind him, and is not at all likely to tolerate much rudeness. I am a very quiet man, as a usual thing, but, my dear sir, you are either going to oblige me in the little matter of which you are aware, or you shall very bitterly repent that you ever admitted me to your antechamber." The president laughed aloud. "That is the way to speak," said he. "You are a man who is a man. You know the way to my heart, and can do what you like with me. Will you," he continued, addressing Geraldine, "will you step aside for a few minutes? I shall finish first with your companion, and some of the club's formalities require to be fulfilled in private." With these words he opened the door of a small closet, into which he shut the colonel. "I believe in you," he said to Florizel as soon as they were alone, "but are you sure of your friend?" "Not so sure as I am of myself, though he has more cogent reasons," answered Florizel, "but sure enough to bring him here without alarm. He has had enough to cure the most tenacious man of life. He was cashiered the other day for cheating at cards." "A good reason, I dare say," replied the president. "At least we have another in the same case, and I feel sure of him. Have you also been in the service, may I ask?" "I have," was the reply, "but I was too lazy. I left it early." "What is your reason for being tired of life?" pursued the president. "The same, as near as I can make out," answered the prince. "Unadulterated laziness." The president started. "Damn it," said he, "you must have something better than that." "I have no more money," added Florizel. "That is also a vexation, without doubt. It brings my sense of idleness to an acute point." The president rolled a cigar round in his mouth for some seconds, directing his gaze straight into the eyes of this unusual neophyte, but the prince supported his scrutiny with unabashed good temper. "If I had not a deal of experience," said the president at last, "I should turn you off. But I know the world, and this much anyway, that the most frivolous excuses for a suicide are often the toughest to stand by. And when I downright like a man, as I do you, sir, I would rather strain the regulation than deny him." You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. Continuing our story. The prince and the colonel, one after the other, were subjected to a long and particular interrogatory, the prince alone, but Geraldine in the presence of the prince, so that the president might observe the countenance of the one while the other was being warmly cross-examined. The result was satisfactory, and the president, after having booked a few details of each case, produced a form of oath to be accepted. Nothing could be conceived more passive than the obedience promised, or more stringent than the terms by which the juror bound himself. The man who forfeited a pledge so awful could scarcely have a rag of honor or any of the consolations of religion left to him. Florizel signed the document, but not without a shudder. The colonel followed his example with an air of great depression. Then the president received the entry money, and without more ado introduced the two friends into the smoking room of the Suicide Club. The smoking room of the Suicide Club was the same height as the cabinet into which it opened, but much larger, and papered from top to bottom with an imitation of oak wainscot. A large and cheerful fire and a number of gas jets illuminated the company. The prince and his follower made the number up to 18. Most of the party were smoking and drinking champagne. A feverish hilarity reigned, with sudden and rather ghastly pauses. "Is this a full meeting?" asked the prince. "Middling," said the president. "By the way," he added, "if you have any money, it is usual to offer some champagne. It keeps up a good spirit and is one of my own little perquisites. Hammersmith, said Florizel, I may leave the champagne to you. And with that he turned away and began to go round among the guests. Accustomed to play the host in the highest circles, he charmed and dominated all who he approached. There was something at once winning and authoritative in his address, and his extraordinary coolness gave him yet another distinction in this half-maniacal society. As he went from one to another, he kept both his eyes and ears open, and soon began to gain a general idea of the people among whom he found himself. As in all other places of resort, one type predominated. People in the prime of youth, with every show of intelligence and sensibility in their appearance, but with little promise of strength or the quality that makes success. Few were much above 30, and not a few of them were still in their teens. They stood leaning on tables and shifting on their feet. Sometimes they smoked extraordinarily fast, and sometimes they let their cigars go out. Some talked well, but the conversation of others was plainly the result of nervous tension, and was equally without wit or purport. As each new bottle of champagne was opened, there was a manifest improvement in gaiety. Only two were seated, one in a chair in the recess of the window, with his head hanging and his hands plunged deep into his trouser pockets, pale, visibly moist with perspiration, saying never a word, a very wreck of soul and body. The other sat on the divan close by the chimney and attracted notice by a trenchant dissimilarity from all the rest. He was probably upward of 40, but he looked fully 10 years older, and Florizel thought he had never seen a man more naturally hideous, nor one more ravaged by disease and ruinous excitements. He was no more than skin and bone, was partly paralyzed, and wore spectacles of such unusual power that his eyes appeared through the glasses greatly magnified and distorted in shape. Except the prince and the president, he was the only person in the room who preserved the composure of ordinary life. There was little decency among the members of the club. Some boasted of the disgraceful actions, the consequences of which had reduced them to seek refuge in death, and the others listened without disapproval. There was a tacit understanding against moral judgments, and whoever passed the club doors enjoyed already some of the immunities of the tomb. They drank to each other's memories and to those of notable suicides in the past. They compared and developed their different views of death, some declaring that it was no more than blackness and cessation, others full of a hope that that very night they should be scaling the stars and conversing with the mighty dead. To the eternal memory of Baron Trenck, the type of suicides, cried one. He went out of a small cell into a smaller, that he might come forth again to freedom. For my part, said a second, I wish no more than a bandage for my eyes and cotton for my ears, only they have no cotton thick enough in this world. A third was for reading the mysteries of life in a future state, and a fourth professed that he would never have joined the club if he had not been induced to believe in Mr. Darwin. I could not bear, said this remarkable suicide, to be descended from an ape. Altogether the prince was disappointed by the bearing and the conversation of the members. It does not seem to me, he thought, a matter for so much disturbance. If a man has made up his mind to kill himself, let him do it in God's name like a gentleman. This flutter and big talk is out of place. In the meanwhile, Colonel Geraldine was a prey to the blackest apprehensions. The club and its rules were still a mystery, and he looked round the room for someone who should be able to set his mind at rest. In this survey, his eyes lighted on the paralytic person with the strong spectacles, and seeing him so exceedingly tranquil, he besought the president, who was going in and out of the room under a pressure of business, to present him to the gentleman on the divan. The functionary explained the needlessness of all such formalities within the club, but nevertheless presented Mr. Hammersmith to Mr. Malthus. Mr. Malthus looked at the colonel curiously and then requested him to take a seat upon his right. "You are a newcomer," he said, "and wish information? You have come to the proper source. It is 2 years since I first visited this charming club." The colonel breathed again. If Mr. Malthus had frequented the place for 2 years, there could be little danger for the prince in a single evening. But Geraldine was none the less astonished and began to suspect a mystification. "What?" cried he. 2 years? I thought, but indeed I see I have been made the subject of a pleasantry." "By no means," replied Mr. Malthus mildly. "My case is peculiar. I am not, properly speaking, a suicide at all, but, as it were, an honorary member. I rarely visit the club twice in 2 months. My infirmity and the kindness of the president have procured me these little immunities, for which, besides, I pay at an advanced rate. Even as it is, my luck has been extraordinary. "I'm afraid," said the colonel, "that I must ask you to be more explicit. You must remember that I am still most imperfectly acquainted with the rules of the club." "An ordinary member who comes here in search of death like yourself," replied the paralytic, "returns every evening until fortune favors him. He can, even if he is penniless, get board and lodging from the president. Very fair, I believe, and clean, although, of course, not luxurious. That could hardly be, considering the exiguity, if I may so express myself, of the subscription. And then the president's company is a delicacy in itself." "Indeed," cried Geraldine, "he has not greatly prepossessed me." "Ah," said Mr. Malthus, "you do not know the man, the drollest fellow. What stories, what cynicism! He knows life to admiration, and between ourselves is probably the most corrupt rogue in Christendom. And he also," asked the colonel, "is a permanency like yourself, if I may say so without offense." "Indeed, he is a permanency in a very different sense from me," replied Mr. Malthus. "I have been graciously spared, but I must go at last. Now he never plays. He shuffles and deals for the club and makes the necessary arrangements. That man, my dear Mr. Hammersmith, is a very soul of ingenuity. For 3 years he pursued in London his useful, and I think I may add, his artistic calling, and not so much as a whisper of suspicion has been once aroused. I believe him myself to be inspired. You doubtless remember the celebrated case 6 months ago of a gentleman who was accidentally poisoned in a chemist's shop? That was one of the least rich, one of the least racy of his notions, but then how simple and how safe!" "You astound me," said the colonel. "Was that unfortunate gentleman one of the—" He was about to say victims, but bethinking himself in time, he substituted, "members of the club?" In the same flash of thought, it occurred to him that Mr. Malthus himself had not at all spoken in the tone of one who is in love with death, and he added hurriedly, "But I perceive I am still in the dark. You speak of shuffling and dealing. Pray, for what end? And since you seem rather unwilling to die than otherwise, I must own that I cannot conceive what brings you here at all." "You say truly that you are in the dark," replied Mr. Malthus with more animation. "Why, my dear sir, this club is the temple of intoxication. If my enfeebled health could support the excitement more often, you may depend upon it that I should be here more often. It requires all the sense of duty engendered by a long habit of ill health and careful regimen to keep me from excess in this, which is, I may say, my last dissipation. I have tried them all, sir," he went on, laying his hand on Geraldine's arm, "all without exception, and I declare to you, upon my honor, there is not one of them that has not been grossly and untruthfully overrated. People trifle with love. Now I deny that love is a strong passion. Fear is the strong passion. It is with fear that you must trifle if you wish to taste the intense joys of living. Envy me, sir," he added with a chuckle. "I am a coward." Geraldine could scarcely repress a movement of repulsion for this deplorable wretch, but he commanded himself with an effort and continued his inquiries. "How, sir," he asked, "is the excitement so artfully prolonged, and where is there any element of uncertainty?" "I must tell you how the victim for every evening is selected," returned Mr. Malthus, "and not only the victim but another member who is to be the instrument in the club's hands and the death's high priest of that occasion." "Good God," said the colonel, "do they then kill each other?" "The trouble of suicide is removed in that way," returned Malthus with a nod. "Merciful heavens," ejaculated the colonel, "and may you, may I, may the, my friend I mean, may any of us be pitched upon this evening as a slayer of another man's body and immortal spirit? Can such things be possible among men born of women? O infamy of infamies!" He was about to rise in his horror when he caught the prince's eye. It was fixed upon him from across the room with a frowning and angry stare, and in a moment Geraldine recovered his composure. "After all," he added, "why not? And since you say the game is interesting, vogue la galère, I follow the club." Mr. Malthus had cleanly enjoyed the colonel's amazement and disgust. He had the vanity of wickedness, and it pleased him to see another man give way to a generous movement, while he felt himself in his entire corruption superior to such emotions. "You now, after your first moment of surprise," said he, "are in a position to appreciate the delights of our society. You can see how it combines the excitements of a gaming table, a duel, and a Roman amphitheater. The pagans did well enough. I cordially admire the refinement of their minds, but it has been reserved for a Christian country to attain this extreme. this quintessence, this absolute of poignancy. You understand how vapid are all amusements to a man who has acquired a taste for this one. The game we play, he continued, is one of extreme simplicity. A full pack, but I perceive you are about to see the thing in progress. Will you lend me the help of your arm? I am unfortunately paralyzed. Indeed, just as Mr. Malthus was beginning his description, another pair of folding doors was thrown open, and the whole club began to pass, not without some hurry, into the adjoining room. It was similar in every respect to the one from which it was entered, but somewhat differently furnished. The center was occupied by a long green table at which the president sat shuffling a pack of cards with great particularity. Even with the stick in the colonel's arm, Mr. Malthus walked with so much difficulty that everyone was seated before this pair and the prince, who had waited for them, entered the apartment, and in consequence the three took seats close together at the lower end of the board. "It is a pack of 52," whispered Mr. Malthus. "Watch for the ace of spades, which is the sign of death, and the ace of clubs, which designates the official of the night. Happy, happy young men," he added. "You have good eyes and can follow the game. Alas, I cannot tell an ace from a deuce across the table." And he proceeded to equip himself with a second pair of spectacles. "I must at least watch the faces," he explained. The colonel rapidly informed his friend of all that he had learned from the honorary member, and of the horrible alternative that lay before them. The prince was conscious of a deadly chill and a contraction about his heart. He swallowed with difficulty and looked from side to side like a man in a maze. "One bold stroke," whispered the colonel, "and we may still escape." But the suggestion recalled the prince's spirits. "Silence," said he. "Let me see that you can play like a gentleman for any stake, however serious." And he looked about him once more, to all appearance at his ease, although his heart beat thickly, and he was conscious of an unpleasant heat in his bosom. The members were all very quiet and intent. Everyone was pale, but none so pale as Mr. Malthus. His eyes protruded, his head kept nodding involuntarily upon his spine. His hands found their way, one after the other, to his mouth, where they made clutches at his tremulous and ashen lips. It was plain that the honorary member enjoyed his membership on very startling terms. "Attention, gentlemen," said the president. And he began slowly dealing the cards about the table in the reverse direction, pausing until each man had shown his card. Nearly everyone hesitated, and sometimes you would see a player's finger stumble more than once before he could turn over the momentous slip of pasteboard. As the prince's turn drew nearer, he was conscious of a growing and almost suffocating excitement, but he had somewhat of the gambler's nature and recognized almost with astonishment that there was a degree of pleasure in his sensations. The nine of clubs fell to his lot, the three of spades was dealt to Geraldine, and the queen of hearts to Mr. Malthus, who was unable to suppress a sob of relief. The young man of the cream tarts almost immediately afterward turned over the ace of clubs and remained frozen with horror, the card still resting on his finger. He had not come there to kill, but to be killed, and the prince, in his generous sympathy with his position, almost forgot the peril that still hung over himself and his friend. The deal was coming round again, and still death's card had not come out. The players held their respiration and only breathed by gasps. The prince received another club. Geraldine had a diamond, but when Mr. Malthus turned up his card, a horrible noise, like that of something breaking, issued from his mouth, and he rose from his seat and sat down again with no sign of his paralysis. It was the ace of spades. The honorary member had trifled once too often with his terrors. Conversation broke out again almost at once. The players relaxed their rigid attitudes and began to rise from the table and stroll back by twos and threes into the smoking room. The president stretched his arms and yawned like a man who had finished his day's work. But Mr. Malthus sat in his place with his head in his hands and his hands upon the table, drunk and motionless, a thing stricken down. The prince and Geraldine made their escape at once. In the cold night air, their horror of what they had witnessed was redoubled. "Alas," cried the prince, "to be bound by an oath in such a matter, to allow this wholesale trade and murder to be continued with profit and impunity, if I but dare to forfeit my pledge." "That is impossible for your highness," replied the colonel, "whose honor is the honor of Bohemia, but I dare and may with propriety forfeit mine." "Geraldine," said the prince, "if your honor suffers in any of the adventures into which you follow me, not only will I never pardon you, but what I believe will much more sensibly affect you, I should never forgive myself." I receive your highness's commands, replied the colonel. Shall we go from this accursed spot? Yes, said the prince. Call a cab in heaven's name, and let me try to forget and slumber the memory of this night's disgrace. But it was notable that he carefully read the name of the court before he left it. The next morning, as soon as the prince was stirring, Colonel Geraldine brought him a daily newspaper with the following paragraph marked, Melancholy Accident. This morning about 2 o'clock, Mr. Bartholomew Malthus of 16 Chepstow Place, Westbourne Grove, on his way home from a party at a friend's house, fell over the upper parapet in Trafalgar Square, fracturing his skull and breaking a leg and an arm. Death was instantaneous. Mr. Malthus, accompanied by a friend, was engaged in looking for a cab at the time of the unfortunate occurrence. As Mr. Malthus was paralytic, it is thought that his fall may have been occasioned by another seizure. The unhappy gentleman was well known in the most respectable circles, and his loss will be widely and deeply deplored. If ever a soul went straight to hell, said Geraldine solemnly, it was that paralytic man's. The prince buried his face in his hands and remained silent. I am almost rejoiced, continued the colonel, to know that he is dead. But for our young man of the cream tarts, I confess my heart bleeds. Geraldine, said the prince, raising his face, that unhappy lad was last night as innocent as you and I, and this morning the guilt of blood is on his soul. When I think of the president, my heart grows sick within me. I do not know how it shall be done, but I shall have that scoundrel at my mercy, as there is a God in heaven. What an experience, what a lesson, was that game of cards. One, said the colonel, never to be repeated. The prince remained so long without replying that Geraldine grew alarmed. You cannot mean to return, he said. You have suffered too much and seen too much horror already. The duties of your high position forbid the repetition of the hazard. There is much in what you say, replied Prince Florizel, and I am not altogether pleased with my own determination. Alas, in the clothes of the greatest potentate, what is there but a man? I never felt my weakness more acutely than now, Geraldine, but it is stronger than I. Can I cease to interest myself in the fortunes of the unhappy young man who supped with us some hours ago? Can I leave the president to follow his nefarious career unwatched? Can I begin an adventure so entrancing and not follow it to an end? No, Geraldine, you ask of the prince more than the man is able to perform. Tonight, once more, we take our places at the table of the Suicide Club. Colonel Geraldine fell upon his knees. Will your highness take my life, he cried. It is his freely, but do not, oh, do not, let him ask me to countenance so terrible a risk. Colonel Geraldine, replied the prince, with some haughtiness of manner, your life is absolutely your own. I only look for obedience, and when that is unwillingly rendered, I shall look for that no longer. I add one word. Your importunity in this affair has been sufficient. The master of the horse regained his feet at once. Your highness, he said, may I be excused in my attendance this afternoon? I dare not, as an honorable man, venture a second time into that fatal house until I have perfectly ordered my affairs. Your highness shall meet, I promise him, with no more opposition from the most devoted and grateful of his servants. My dear Geraldine, returned Prince Florizel, I always regret when you oblige me to remember my rank. Dispose of your day as you think fit, but be here before 11 in the same disguise. The club on this second evening was not so fully attended, and when Geraldine and the prince arrived, there were not above half a dozen persons in the smoking room. His highness took the president aside and congratulated him warmly on the demise of Mr. Malthus. I like, he said, to meet with capacity, and certainly find much of it in you. Your profession is of a very delicate nature, but I see you are well qualified to conduct it with success and secrecy. The president was somewhat affected by these compliments from one of his highness's superior being. He acknowledged them almost with humility. Poor Malthy, he added, I shall hardly know the club without him. The most of my patrons are boys, sir, and poetical boys who are not much company for me. Not but what Malthy had some poetry too, but it was of a kind that I could understand. I can readily imagine you should find yourself in sympathy with Mr. Malthus, returned the prince. He struck me as a man of a very original disposition. The young man of the cream tarts was in the room, but painfully depressed and silent. His late companion sought in vain to lead him into conversation. How bitterly I wish, he cried, that I had never brought you to this infamous abode. Begone while you are clean-handed. If you could have heard the old man scream as he fell and the noise of his bones upon the pavement, wish me, if you have any kindness to so fallen a being, wish the ace of spades for me tonight. A few more members dropped in as the evening went on, but the club did not muster more than the devil's dozen when they took their places at the table. The prince was again conscious of a certain joy in his alarms, but he was astonished to see Geraldine so much more self-possessed than on the night before. "It is extraordinary," thought the prince, "that a will, made or unmade, should so greatly influence a young man's spirit." "Attention, gentlemen," said the president, and he began to deal. Three times the cards went all around the table, and neither of the marked cards had yet fallen from his hand. The excitement as he began the fourth distribution was overwhelming. There were just cards enough to go once more entirely round. The prince, who sat second from the dealer's left, would receive, in the reverse mode of dealing practiced at the club, the second last card. The third player picked up a black ace. It was the ace of clubs. The next received a diamond, the next a heart, and so on, but the ace of spades was still undelivered. At last Geraldine, who sat upon the prince's left, turned his card. It was an ace, but the ace of hearts. When Prince Florizel saw his fate upon the table in front of him, his heart stood still. He was a brave man, but the sweat poured off his face. There were exactly 50 chances out of 100 that he was doomed. He reversed the card. It was the ace of spades. A loud roaring filled his brain, and the table swam before his eyes. He heard the player on his right break into a fit of laughter that sounded between mirth and disappointment. He saw the company rapidly dispersing, but his mind was full of other thoughts. He recognized how foolish, how criminal had been his conduct. In perfect health, in the prime of his years, the heir to a throne, he had gambled away his future and that of a brave and loyal country. "God," he cried, "God forgive me," and with that the confusion of his senses passed away and he regained his self-possession in a moment. To his surprise, Geraldine had disappeared. There was no one in the card room but his destined butcher consulting with the president and the young man of the cream tarts who slipped up to the prince and whispered in his ear, "I would give a million if I had it for your luck." His Highness could not help reflecting as the young man departed that he would have sold his opportunity for a much more moderate sum. The whispered conference now came to an end. The holder of the ace of clubs left the room with a look of intelligence, and the president, approaching the unfortunate prince, proffered him his hand. "I am pleased to have met you, sir," said he, "and pleased to have been in a position to do you this trifling service. At least you cannot complain of delay. On the second evening, what a stroke of luck!" The prince endeavored in vain to articulate something in response, but his mouth was dry and his tongue seemed paralyzed. "You feel a little sickish?" asked the president, with some show of solicitude. "Most gentlemen do. Will you take a little brandy?" The prince signified in the affirmative, and the other immediately poured some of the spirit into a tumbler. "Poor old Malthy!" ejaculated the president as the prince drained the glass. He drank near upon a pint, and little enough good it seemed to do him. "I am more amenable to treatment," said the prince, a good deal revived. "I am my own man again at once, as you perceive. And so, let me ask you, what are my directions?" "You will proceed along the Strand in the direction of the city, and on the left-hand pavement until you meet the gentleman who has just left the room. He will continue your instructions, and him you will have the kindness to obey. The authority of the club is vested in his person for the night. And now," added the president, "I wish you a pleasant walk." Florizel acknowledged the salutation rather awkwardly and took his leave. He passed through the smoking room, where the bulk of the players were still consuming champagne, some of which he had himself ordered and paid for, and he was surprised to find himself cursing them in his heart. He put on his hat and greatcoat in the cabinet and selected his umbrella from a corner. The familiarity of these acts and the thought that he was about them for the last time betrayed him into a fit of laughter, which sounded unpleasantly in his own ears. He conceived a reluctance to leave the cabinet and turned instead to the window. The sight of the lamps and the darkness recalled him to himself. "Come, come, I must be a man," he thought, "and tear myself away." At the corner of Box Court, three men fell upon Prince Florizel, and he was unceremoniously thrust into a carriage, which at once drove rapidly away. There was already an occupant. "Will your Highness pardon my zeal?" said a well-known voice. The prince threw himself upon the colonel's neck in a passion of relief. "How can I ever thank you?" he cried, "and how was this effected?" Although he had been willing to march upon his doom, he was overjoyed to yield to friendly violence and returned once more to life and hope. "You can thank me effectually enough," replied the colonel, "by avoiding all such dangers in the future. And as for your second question, all has been managed by the simplest means. I arranged this afternoon with a celebrated detective. Secrecy has been promised and paid for. Your own servants have been principally engaged in the affair. The house in Box Court has been surrounded since nightfall, and this, which is one of your own carriages, has been awaiting you for nearly an hour. "And the miserable creature who was to have slain me, what of him?" inquired the prince. "He was pinioned as he left the club," replied the colonel, "and now awaits your sentence at the palace, where he will soon be joined by his accomplices." "Geraldine," said the prince, "you have saved me against my explicit orders, and you have done well. I owe you not only my life, but a lesson, and I should be unworthy of my rank if I did not show myself grateful to my teacher. Let it be yours to choose the manner." There was a pause, during which the carriage continued to speed through the streets, and the two men were each buried in his own reflections. The silence was broken by Colonel Geraldine. "Your Highness," said he, "has by this time a considerable body of prisoners. There is at least one criminal among the number to whom justice should be dealt. Our oath forbids us all recourse to law, and discretion would forbid it equally if the oath were loosened. May I inquire your Highness's intention?" "It is decided," answered Florizel. "The president must fall in duel. It only remains to choose his adversary." "Your Highness has permitted me to name my own recompense," said the colonel. "Will he permit me to ask the appointment of my brother? It is an honorable post, but I dare assure your Highness that the lad will acquit himself with credit." "You ask me an ungracious favor," said the prince, "but I must refuse you nothing." The colonel kissed his hand with the greatest affection, and at that moment the carriage rolled under the archway of the prince's splendid residence. An hour after, Florizel, in his official robes and covered with all the orders of Bohemia, received the members of the Suicide Club. "Foolish and wicked men," said he, "as many of you as have been driven into this strait by the lack of fortune shall receive employment and remuneration from my officers. Those who suffer under a sense of guilt must have recourse to a higher and more generous potentate than I. I feel pity for all of you, deeper than you can imagine. Tomorrow you shall tell me your stories, and as you answer more frankly, I shall be the more able to remedy your misfortunes. As for you," he added, turning to the president, "I should only offend a person of your parts by any offer of assistance, but I have instead a piece of diversion to propose to you. Here," laying his hand on the shoulder of Colonel Geraldine's young brother, "is an officer of mine who desires to make a little tour upon the continent, and I ask you as a favor to accompany him on this excursion. Do you," he went on, changing his tone, "do you shoot well with the pistol? Because you may have need of that accomplishment. When two men go traveling together, it's best to be prepared for all. Let me add that, if by any chance you should lose young Mr. Geraldine upon the way, I shall always have another member of my household to place at your disposal, and I am known, Mr. President, to have long eyesight and as long an arm." With these words, said with much sternness, the prince concluded his address. Next morning, the members of the club were suitably provided for by his munificence, and the president set forth upon his travels under the supervision of Mr. Geraldine and a pair of faithful and adroit lackeys well trained in the prince's household. Not content with this, discreet agents were put in possession of the house of Box Court, and all letters of visitors for the Suicide Club or its officials were to be examined by Prince Florizel in person. And that was The Suicide Club by Robert Louis Stevenson from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill.